Iran says it will provide the European Union with its latest conclusion on the talks to revive the 2015 nuclear deal by midnight Monday. At least three people are killed and several more injured as Israel launches fresh missile strikes on Syria from over Lebanon. China says a U.S. congressional delegation's visit to Taiwan fully exposes the true face of Washington as saboteur of peace in Taiwan Strait. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. The top story, Iranian foreign minister says that the country will offer its final conclusion on the revival of the 2015 nuclear agreement by midnight local time. That's 21:30 GMT. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says Iran sees no obstacle to a deal if its red lines are respected. The top diplomat added that Washington must show flexibility if it wants to restore the nuclear accord. He warned that Iran has its own plan B if the talks for the revival of the JCPOA fail. Now, the comments came a week after he put forward what they call a final text following 4 days of indirect talks between the U.S. and Iran in the Austrian capital. The JCPOA was thrown into chaos after the U.S. unilaterally withdrew in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. Parties to the accord had been holding talks to restore the deal since early last year. The Iranian foreign ministry says that no one except Salman Rushdie and his supporters should be blamed for the Friday stabbing attack against the anti-Islam writer. Spokesman Nasser Kanani says that Rushdie crossed the red lines of over 1 billion Muslims by insulting their sanctities. He said that this exposed the blasphemous writer to the anger of Muslims and others. The spokesman also categorically denied any link between Iran and the attacker. He said nobody has the right to accuse Iran in this connection. Rushdie, who authored a hugely controversial book against Islam in the 1980s, was stabbed at a public appearance in the U.S. state of New York on Friday. The attacker is in custody and has been accused of second-degree murder. A political commentator, Mohsen Abbas, says that Salman Rushdie was a tool in the hands of the West to confront Islam.
On an individual level, he'd kind of outlived his usefulness. I guess Rushdie takes the inauspicious honor or denigration of being, the first potential tool of Western neoliberal deep state in that process of its war on Islam, the real Islam which talks about justice and talks about governments which should be just and talks about a system which is, you know, anti-usurious perhaps, anti-corruption, anti-exploitation of the masses.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned the latest deadly strikes by Israel against Syria. The movement says that the strikes come shortly after Israel's violations in the occupied territories and against the Gaza Strip. Hamas says that regional nations should stand up to the regime and end such crimes. The Israeli military hit areas near the Syrian capital Damascus and in Tartus, which lies on the Mediterranean coast. The attacks killed three people and injured three others. Syrian air defenses reportedly intercepted some of the incoming missiles over Tartus. Well, I just talked to our correspondent in Damascus. Mohammed Ali has given us a wider picture of the reactions to Israel's deadly strike in Tartus.
Almost every time there is an attack, the Syrian foreign ministry sends letters to the United Nations Secretary General and Security Council calling on the international body to take action, to condemn such attacks, to shoulder its responsibility in preserving international peace and security. But up till this moment, we've seen no action taken against such attacks by Israel, despite the fact that those attacks do not just undermine Syria's sovereignty, but they kill sometimes civilians, and also they threaten and endanger not just civilians in Syria, but by using Lebanese airspace also, they threaten civilian flights over Damascus and Lebanon. Despite all of those issues, there is still international silence over such attacks.
A Palestinian man has been killed in yet another Israeli operation in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces shot Mohammed al-Shaham in the head during a raid on his home in the town of Kafr Aqab, north al-Quds. The region's military has performed almost daily raids in different areas of the occupied West Bank over the past months. They frequently lead to deadly violence against Palestinians as they turn out to protest the raids. The Israeli military also launched a three-day onslaught on the Gaza Strip last week, killing dozens of civilians and wounding 360 others. Mona Kendall has more details about the killing of the young man near Al-Quds.
This time, Israeli forces and police undercover units raided the town of Kafr Aqab. It's East Al-Quds, one of the of East Al-Quds towns, northern Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and in order, as usual, to conduct arrests. This is what the Israelis claim. But according to the family of this young Palestinian, Mohammed al-Shaham, it's an assassination because they raided the house of al-Shaham family, and when family members left their rooms, they were sleeping, of course. It was around 4 or 5 a.m. in the morning. They left their rooms when they were surprised by the Israeli soldiers in their house. They immediately tried to return back to escape or something like this. They were surprised. But immediately, Israeli forces shot in the head Mohammed al-Shaham directly without doing anything. So the family members and his father specifically is accusing the Israeli forces for assassinating his son. It was not an arrest campaign or an arrest operation because they didn't order him to, let's say, obey the orders or arrest him, or there were clashes between the Palestinians and the Israeli forces.
It's the 16th anniversary of Lebanon's victory in its 33-day war against the Tel Aviv regime. The occasion is annually commemorated by holding celebrations, but this year's ceremonies were postponed due to the Muslim mourning month of Muharram. The 2006 war began with Israeli airstrikes against Lebanese cities in July and ended by a UN-backed ceasefire. The aggression killed more than 1,200 people, mostly civilians in Lebanon, and resulted in the demolition of vital infrastructure. Israel also launched a war in Lebanon in 2000. On both occasions, Hezbollah resistance fighters defeated the Israeli forces, and Tel Aviv was forced to retreat without achieving any of its objectives. Human rights activist Firas al-Najm argues that Lebanon's victory in that war shattered the myth of Israel's invincibility and also broke new ground for others to follow.
It was a good example, I think, for all the resistance in the region, and especially the Palestinians that are occupied by the Zionist regime. It was a great example that you can defeat the Zionist regime. That the Zionist regime, you know, the way the mainstream media has pictured them as if they're, you know, undefeatable, and they are one of the mightiest armies in the region, and they have the most sophisticated weapons, and they have the most you know, amount of governments in the world or regimes, you can say, that support them, and you know, there's no way to defeat them and humiliate them, that they will take over and they will destroy any area. Yes, they did do a lot of destruction in Lebanon, but they were still pushed out of Lebanon and they were humiliated, and at the same time all their objectives in the 33-day war in 2006 were a failure. You know, they wanted to pull them back behind the river. They wanted to destroy their military infrastructure, Hezbollah's military infrastructure. And they also said that they would release, get those prisoners that Hezbollah captured, released without any negotiations and without any losses. But thankfully, that all their objectives, their three objectives, main objectives, were all lost. And they lost everything. And they had to pull out, and the United Nations mediated, and they put the UNIFIL forces in between, you know, to stop the war. But at the end of the day, Hezbollah was able to release all the Lebanese prisoners at the end, and they gave them back two dead, as I remember, soldiers, IDF soldiers.
The Chinese Defense Ministry says an ongoing visit by American lawmakers to Taiwan fully exposes the U.S.'s face as a troublemaker and saboteur of peace. The ministry says that Beijing will smash any foreign interference in its domestic affairs. The five-member congressional delegation is in Taiwan to hold security talks with the island's president. Beijing considers Taiwan part of its territory. It's repeatedly warned the U.S. over its ties with the island. Meantime, China's military is planning more drills near Taiwan. It says that the exercises are a stern deterrent to the U.S. and as political games to undermine regional peace. Afghanistan marking the first anniversary of the Taliban's return to power and the chaotic withdrawal of the U.S. forces following 20 years of occupation. The Taliban announced Monday a national holiday. A year ago, the forces captured Kabul following a blitz against government forces. Afghanistan has seen a rise in attacks against the local Shia population since the Taliban seized power. The country is also facing a humanitarian crisis. Aid agencies say that half of the entire population is struggling with extreme poverty. To make matters worse, the U.S. froze nearly $9 billion in Afghan assets. The UN and other international bodies have called on Washington to release the funds to allow Afghanistan to deal with its crises. In recent years, the United States has fought wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Pakistan, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen, and those are just the ones that the Pentagon has officially acknowledged. The actual scope of American war-making is much wider. A new research has revealed that the U.S. has undertaken almost 400 military interventions from its founding in 1776 to 2019.
How many wars is the United States fighting right now? Well, the answer is zero, as under the Constitution, Congress must declare war, and the last countries that Congress declared war on were Bulgaria, Romania, and Hungary in 1942. 8 decades and what seems to be zero wars. Any countries with such a record must be one of the most peaceful places on earth. But as history has shown, this is not the case with the US, as it is fighting and has waged wars on many countries across the world. It just doesn't want to call them wars. Over the last 20 years, the US has dropped an average of 46 bombs and missiles on other countries each day. And now, a new study has revealed that more than a quarter of the 400 wars which the U.S. has sugarcoated in terms such as a military-led operation, police actions, or humanitarian interventions have taken place in West Asia and Africa. So it seems that as Americans struggle to address urgent needs at home, their governments have committed them to endless wars in an attempt to support what seems to be one of the key pillars of the U.S., the military-industrial complex.
The U.S. has tried to be on the first hand with an image of also being seen as a global policeman, which came and, of course, as some have argued, it's done more harm than good. When you look into the global dominance and production of all these weapons and also use of it in terms of interventions, you see a situation whereby U.S. wants to be the first, to be seen the most powerful nation in the world, to be seen as the one that can intervene and maybe make a difference, whichever difference whose interest it serves. Of course, they will have to define that. It's a bit a gray area. You cannot define it very clearly.
With no beginning declared and no end in sight, these wars seem to have become the new normal around the globe. Instead of helping build a safer world, the U.S. has chosen to expand its never-ending wars. Apart from causing massive destruction, these military interventions lead to what Washington calls collateral damage, a euphemism for all the innocent people killed in war zones.
The world seems to have entered a new era after the Second World War, one where relations between countries has been at a much more stable and peaceful state. But while the decline of war and the relative harmony among great powers is cause for celebration, the U.S. seems to believe otherwise in light of its grand strategy and political powers that seem to be running its system, namely the military-industrial complex. The U.S. has constantly, since the Cold War, intervened in foreign affairs and engulfed itself in wars far from its borders, wars which in most cases seemed endless and even pointless at times. But while the U.S. military is swamped in conflicts in other countries, it's hard to see any end in sight, especially an end where it is the victor. A month into his presidency, Donald Trump said that the U.S. no longer wins wars as it once did. And the reason behind this might be the fact that the U.S. isn't necessarily in wars. It is in fact in foreign interventions where its presence has more often than not worsened the situation, further aggravating an already chaotic crisis. And all this may only be to support the thriving war business in the U.S. Big war CEOs say the chaos in the world has led to excellent prospects for them, while arms contractors say recent violence and tensions in the Ukraine conflict works in their shareholders' favor. And this leads to the questions that do war manufacturers and U.S. foreign policy go hand in hand in promoting wars?
You think about the terrorism happening within the Sahel region, and of course, U.S. is an intervention in power also. They have to do what they have to do, use of drones and all these things. So they are giving us another reason as well. But elsewhere, whether it's in East Africa, Somali intervention, this is also given a different reason, campaign, war against terror. So there's always a reason being given. So therefore, war never looks like it's been manufactured or it's been planned, deliberately planned or calculated. To maybe maximize sales of weapons. But truth be told, that whenever there's a conflict, weapons will always be used.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Iranian Radio. Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Economic divide.
The Puerto Rico Power Company brought out the anger of Puerto Ricans recently, who took to the streets slamming the government for its bad economic policies. But that was just the tip of the iceberg. The economy in that country was not doing well, and that's one of the main reasons why they came out, a result of U.S. execution of things like bond selling, privatization, and malicious Wall Street debt restructurings. Hi, I'm Kavit Tawai. Welcome to Economic Divide. Some of the headlines coming up in this program: the PR Puerto Rican electric company controversy, rates to have doubled, governor vetoed price increase bill that angered the citizens of that island. Why did he do that? That's one of the things we'll be looking at. Also, the debt of Puerto Rico, chronic debt for years. The island is blaming the U.S. government. What role did the U.S. government have to play in this? One of the reasons they blame the U.S., the debt adjustment plan. We'll explain to you what that is. Then another issue that has plagued the island, a subject of much debate, Puerto Rican independence, separation from the U.S. Why? Because it does not have the rights that it deserves under the U.S. and the U.S. Constitution. Recently, Puerto Ricans held demonstrations against the local government for its contract with the power grid operator Luma Energy. Demonstrators were fed up with the frequent power outages and massive price hikes. They say that the government needs to remedy the crisis. Since June 2020, when Luma began operating Puerto Rico's electricity transmission, price rates have increased 5 times. The last rate hike, which took effect at the start of July, pushed rates up by over 17%. Back in 2017, Puerto Rico was devastated by the powerful Hurricane Maria, which completely destroyed the island's power grid. Puerto Rico's electricity was already struggling due to low maintenance and poor collection of power bills. Natural disasters, the coronavirus pandemic, migration, government mismanagement, and brutal U.S. debt restructuring plan. Just some of the issues that has plagued Puerto Rico. The economic problems are so deep that many are actually fleeing the island looking for jobs in the U.S. Let's take a look at what people think about some of these economic problems as they have posted online. First up, Puerto Ricans took to the streets of San Juan to fight back against U.S.-imposed privatization of their electricity. Power outages and electricity costs have only increased since Luma Energy took control of the island's electrical grid in 2020. Then Puerto Rican government sitting on $8 billion in cash and uses bankruptcy code to avoid paying $57 million in debt service. The Puerto Rican government and board have hidden real financial conditions of government and litigated against creditors. Unclear that there will ever be market access at reasonable rates. Along the same lines, fees and expenses related to the restructuring of Puerto Rico's debt are forecast to reach $1.6 billion by fiscal year 2026, cementing the island's status as the most expensive municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. Next up, lots of lawyers, CPAs, bankers, finance guys are getting filthy rich. By the way, those were the same people who facilitated the debt binge that bankrupt us or Puerto Rico. All right, joining us to give an idea about the status of Puerto Rico's economy, we have Edwin Irizarry Mora. He's a professor of economics at the University of Puerto Rico joining us. Edwin Irizarry Mora, welcome. Protesters in Puerto Rico are protesting against the rise in electricity prices by Luma Energy. 7 consecutive price rises. It's affecting their lives. And they are complaining about that and, of course, the state of the economy. What is this price rise a result of? A poor governance, do you think?
Well, the issue of electric power production and distribution has been under public discussion for decades. Luma enters in the scenario as a Puerto Rican, as a corporation, I mean, that has been hired to privatize the electric power service. Its presence means that the price is now determined by a private monopoly, and hence the 120% increase in the cost of electricity over the past year, with the justification that the cost of the kilowatt hour generation is high, that's because the monopoly has been established. Of course, it is high. To the extent that electricity is generated with imported fossil fuels, it will continue to be high. On the other hand, from a technical point of view, the presence of a private company does not mean that renewable sources of energy will be adopted. LUMA will continue to produce electricity with the same methods whose vulnerability is accentuated when natural disasters, especially hurricanes, occur. All of the above leads us to conclude that there is a serious governance problem in this issue, and that unfortunately the country's government does not listen to the advice of experts on the subject, because the country's colonial situation imposes on whom fuel is purchased and how electricity is going to be generated. That is why the population has taken to the streets to protest, and with more than justified reasons.
All right, let's bring in Isaac Biggio, see what he thinks. He is a historian and international analyst who joins us. Isaac Biggio, welcome. Protesters are demanding the governor to resign because of this veto that he exercised, preventing further increases in the price of electricity. The bill was proposed to eliminate 75% of the debt also that was held by the Puerto Rican company. Why is it said that the public debt is a product of Puerto Rico's colonial relationship with the U.S.?
Yes, because in Puerto Rico, they are not interested in the situation of the 3 million people that live there, but rather in the interest of the big USA companies. That is why they are increasing the prices of the electricity, despite that Puerto Rico suffered a big hurricane, the pandemic. They are increasing prices of the electricity, and they don't want to go back to public owner electricity. So they prefer to privatize the company and to privatize many services, because that's the policy of the USA, which are not interested in protecting their own population.
It's time now for our InfoNews section of the program, where we take a look at news from around the world with economic flavor to it. Our first news item is on a part of the world that experienced quite a bit of tensions and is still ongoing, a result of the fallout of the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's trip to Chinese Taipei. And it concerns the Taiwan chip industry. Now, why China is not sanctioning Taiwan's key chip industry? Beijing is relying on self-ruled islands as semiconductors, because that will keep its economy on track. Now, we know that China did not like the fact that Nancy Pelosi visited that island. Military operations to the extreme is what they executed. And they also, Chinese authorities, suspended imports of Taiwanese citrus fruits and fish and exports of sand. And that could be just the beginning. So we have to wait and see how that goes. Next up, a topic that we have tackled quite a bit, and that is about the global recession that's really in place. Investors are dumping Chinese stocks. This is one factor that is leading to a global recession, or indications of it. They're also dumping bonds amid global recession fears. The trade group that reported this is pointing to the sixth consecutive month of foreign outflows from China's bond market. The bond market is valued at roughly $20 trillion. That's right, $20 trillion. Next up, what's called a G20 revolt, maybe with a question mark, but it's something that has actually started. G20 states are revolting against U.S. pressure. Half of the G20 nations have not supported the sanctions when it comes to Russia. That's right. It went on to say that the U.S.-led drive to isolate Russia through sanctions has not succeeded, as half the countries in the group of 20 leading global economies are refusing to sign on to that. We have to wait and see how that pans out. And our final pick is on the UK. Again, we've had the UK quite a bit. This concerns the UK energy bills in that country. Well, Brits are not having it. 75,000 of them have vowed to stop paying their energy bills because they're so high. They're going to be tripled in a very short time. The UK government has slammed the Don't Pay campaign, and it has described it as being highly irresponsible. That economy in the UK, obviously one of the aspects, is showing signs of destruction, especially when it comes to people's lives.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Hello and welcome to our in-depth section. The state of Puerto Rico's economy, well, it's in shambles with so much debt. How can this island hope to get back on its feet? It is still suffering from hurricanes like Hurricane Maria, which left the island's infrastructure in ruins. First, let's start out with a comparison of Puerto Rico's electric bills compared to the U.S. That's a good place to see how much more Puerto Ricans are actually paying for it. We have picked three categories that electricity is used in. Namely, the categories would be commercial, industrial, and residential. The one in red being what Puerto Ricans pay. The one in the orange is what the U.S. pays. And as you can see, based on this graph, the question comes, how can businesses survive on this kind of energy costs, which cuts into their bottom line so severely? Never mind how Puerto Ricans can afford an electric bill that's so high. Again, commercial, industrial, residential, all three categories, you can see that Puerto Ricans are paying so much more, maybe double or more than double in the commercial sector. Residential, not that bad. Industrial, still how much more Puerto Ricans are paying. Okay, let's move on to another graph. This one is very important. This graph shows the GDP performance of the island in terms of how its economy is doing. And Puerto Rico's GDP, well, starting from the year 2012, it did have a slight move in the positive direction, but from 2013, 14, 15, 16, all the way through 18, and then you had a slight bump in 19, and then 2020 back, you've had GDP contractions in which the year 2018 came down to more than negative 4%. So you can see that this economy in Puerto Rico has not been doing well, and consecutive contractions have occurred. Bright spot, the year 2021, there was a bit of a bump. That's a promising sign, which it had a positive GDP growth. All right, let's move on to another challenge that the island is facing. This one is huge. It's massive debt and the obligations that it has. Looking at this particular graph over here, these are the top categories of which there needs to have been a restructuring. And what we can see are public pensions, general obligation bonds, and sales tax supported bonds. A grand total of $129 billion of debt restructuring that was required in total. Then you can see the figures over here where the restructuring actually needed to take place. This figure adds up to $86 billion, which was proposed for the debt restructuring. That proposal has actually gone into action. And, of course, you can imagine how hard that is when the island is actually not generating the revenues needed to pay back this debt. So this kind of puts into picture the amount of money indebted accrued and the restructuring that has taken place. All right, next up, Another few indicators of why Puerto Rico's economy just doesn't pick up. This one, we zoomed in on the population growth. Puerto Rican population growth on the mainland declines on island, meaning that the ones who live in Puerto Rico actually end up going to the U.S. And you can see the ones this graph showing how that population is migrating into the U.S. That's another crisis that Puerto Rico is dealing with. When you have people leaving the islands and migrating there, then there's a decline on the island, which means there's a decrease in terms of economic activity. Next up, we're going to take a look at some of the reasons why people are leaving the island. These are pretty typical of actually any country, to be honest. Job-related category is number one at 42%, household and family at 38%, the retired at 7%. These are the main reasons why Puerto Ricans, and the last one is just miscellaneous, the main reasons why Puerto Ricans are actually leaving the island. And as if all these factors were not enough, there is a population decline as a whole for the island. And that decline is not something that actually just occurred. We're looking all the way from the year 2000, 3.8 million Puerto Ricans, and then the gradual decline. It's been steadily declining all the way through to where we are, which is the year 2022. And the projections are through the year 2050. God, all the way through the year 2050. Imagine that, if that were to transpire. All right, let me introduce our guests who are going to rejoin us. Edwin Irizarry-Mora, professor of economics at the University of Puerto Rico, rejoins us to maybe give us some idea of how bad Puerto Rico's economy is doing. All right, Edwin, welcome back to the program. Taking a look at how the U.S. has required that the island needs to repay its debt, it's called a mechanism to pay this debt. The debt adjustment plan is the name. It proposes cuts to the island's government budget and threatens essential services. Do you think that that is the way to go when it comes to Puerto Rico repaying its debt? Will it work aside from preventing the economy to grow?
As I said earlier, since 2016, the Fiscal Oversight Board has determined the priorities of expenditures in Puerto Rico's budget. Undoubtedly, the research carried out in recent years confirms the deterioration of the quality of life of Puerto Ricans in fundamental areas of our collective life, such as public health, pre-university and university education, housing, transportation, and others. An economic system that responds politically to the interests of the United States companies, to creditors who lend money to the government, and to Puerto Rican intermediaries who benefit from that situation because they enrich themselves with the colonial relationship.
Indeed. Well, let's find out what Isaac Biggio thinks. He's a historian and international analyst. Isaac Biggio, welcome back. When you take a look at the way that Puerto Rico's debt has been restructured in particular, obviously this was done with the participation of companies, of creditors. Many of them are obviously Wall Street companies through what is called the debt adjustment plan. Many are saying that this is bankrupting Puerto Rico in a sense, even though the island was bankrupt. Can you explain to us the relationship there and whether this actually prevents the economy in Puerto Rico from advancing in order to repay its debt?
Yes. And the point is that in 1898, there was a war between Spain and the United States. As a consequence of that war, the United States occupies Cuba, Philippines, and Puerto Rico. Cuba became independent. Philippines just celebrated it's on the 4th of July, its independence. It was achieved in 1945. But Puerto Rico is still a kind of colony from the United States. And I don't think that Puerto Rico is going to increase its own conditions unless it breaks with the United States and become another Latin American republic.
Puerto Rico stands in a colonial relationship with the U.S. The U.S. territory has been plagued with recurring debt issues. The island is suffering from an aging population and high costs for social programs. Many of its residents have also left the island because of its debt problem. And access to financial markets is not likely to happen soon because the island needs to get its audited financial statements up to date. Furthermore, the island is struggling with the aftermath of the devastating 2017 hurricane, which left it in tatters. The island has now formally exited bankruptcy, but it came at the expense of tough austerity measures imposed by Washington. The measures made the conditions almost unbearable for ordinary Puerto Ricans. Power grids, railways, healthcare, and other public services were privatized in order to restructure the island's debt crisis.
The debt that Puerto Rico has accumulated is what is dragging down the island's economy. But what led to the island accumulating so much debt? Is there a hidden story there which led to the island recording the largest bankruptcy in U.S. history? Our first cue actually came from an online post, and that is what this post particularly stated. UBS bonds are doing a Ponzi scheme in Puerto Rico. They're taking people's life savings and lying to people, don't buy UBS bonds, the PR government is a Ponzi scheme from U.S. corporations. It goes on to say not to trust UBS bonds, saying that they are Americanized Puerto Rican bonds contributing to the debt. Taking people's life savings, that it is a Ponzi scheme from U.S. corporations. So what was going on with UBS? What was so wrong about the bonds it was selling? Despite the downgrade from UBS Puerto Rico's bonds to junk status as recently as October 2014, UBS Puerto Rico was recommending that some Puerto Rico clients continue to purchase risky UBS closed-end bond funds that held many of the risky Puerto Rico bonds. Here, it is necessary to explain what a junk bond actually is. In finance, junk bonds are bonds that are rated below investment grade, meaning they're believed to be at a higher risk of default. Because of this high risk, they pay higher yields than better quality bonds to make them more attractive to investors. But this doesn't answer the question, why did the investors buy these bonds in the first place? That is because investors in Puerto Rican municipal bonds received favorable tax treatments for years. Bond investors from all 50 states took advantage of this benefit by purchasing Puerto Rican bonds. When a government issues bonds, it is effectively lending money with interest to bondholders. Promoted in large part by this tax advantage, Puerto Rico issued too much bond debt and began relying on borrowed funds from bond issuance to balance its budget. And that is one of the main reasons Puerto Rico's economy tanked when banks like UBS sold these bonds. That does it for this segment of the program. Please let us know what you thought by ending us with your comments. And that is one of the main reasons Puerto Rico's economy tanked when banks like UBS sold these bonds. That does it for this segment of the program.
Puerto Rico's economy has not been doing well for quite some time. Now, we cited since the year 2012, but even before that, jobs were hard to come by, and the island was just not invested in, except for the tourism and the hospitality sector. Well, the island also is suffering from another problem not mentioned that often, and that's drugs and crime. Also, another factor plaguing the island is political status. As U.S. territory, Puerto Rico is neither a state nor an independent country. Maybe that is what is preventing the economy from advancing. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you with us. For Mika Vitahui, it's goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio. And you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights through the Battle of Karbala and the movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi al-salam. Now, me and you, we know that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, he took a handful of companions with him in his journey. According to most narrations, it says there were about 72 of his companions with him and about 30 or 23 of his family members. There were a mixture of people in that camp of the Imam. You had the Arabs, you had the Turks, you had non-Arabs, you had Muslims, you had newly converted to Christians, you had the old, you had the young, you had the white, you had the black, you had the free men, you have the slaves. It was a mixture of people. It was a boat full of different people. What's interestingly, what's highly noticeable in this whole mixture is that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, him being the son of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, the only grandson of the Prophet on the entire earth, he was the holiest man walking the plains of this world. And he had his sons, right? Ali al-Akbar alayhi salam and his brother al-Abbas and his other sons. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, he never looked at himself as superior to any of them, to the Arabs or the Arabs, to the whites or to the blacks. And he did not favor his family over his companions. He did not say, well, Ali al-Akbar is my son, he's the most lookalike to the Prophet, therefore he is better than John, who is a black servant. He never did that. He never did that. He treated everyone exactly the same. From day one until they got killed one by one, or martyred, I should say, one by one, he would treat them the same as his own sons, as his own brothers, without any single difference. And as I will give you the example. So Imam Hussein alayhi salam, for example, when he looks at Ali al-Akbar, his son, and after Ali al-Akbar went to battle and he fell to the ground, he would go to him, and Imam Hussein would pick him up and he would put his cheeks against the cheeks of his son Ali al-Akbar, and he would, you know, talk to him and cry. He'd done the same thing with John, a black servant, and he would pick him up and he would do the same. He would hug him and he would put his cheeks on his cheeks. So he did not discriminate between any of his companions and his family members. He treated them all the same. This is what we call equality between people. This is what we call equality in terms of not trying to be prejudiced, not trying to be racist, not trying to favor people over others. He had his best of companions like Habib, like old companions, compared to newly companions who joined his club or joined his army like the likes of Wahab. He never made distinction between any of his companions. They were to all to him the same. And that is the the best of human rights that we can exercise today when it comes to different races and different colors. Before we get into the topic of racism and discrimination, let us take a short break and then we'll continue right after.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We said that Imam Hussein did not discriminate or show racism between any of his companions and his family members. In fact, he treated them all the same. Me and you, we live in a world where discrimination and racism runs this entire world. And sometimes I and you can find ourselves in the same position without realizing it subconsciously. Because sometimes, on the lowest form of things, sometimes I take too much pride of my own country, of my own people, of my own village, of my own city, of my own, I don't know, even lineage or family name, and I think we are better than the rest. We take too much pride in who we are as a nation or as a country, that we make ourselves superior to others. And you can see this happening across the globe in every country where they see themselves as better than other people. This is like, and this is on the, you know, the tip of the iceberg. And as you go down, you'll see that we discriminate even furthermore when it comes, for example, to black and white, when it comes to color. And until today, even countries and systems where they pride themselves in human rights and in justice, you see that black people, they still don't have rights. And therefore, we have the movement that Black Lives Matter. When you look at the US, for example, and you see that most of the people in prison are black people. Most of the people are prosecuted are black people. Most people are suffering in America are black people. And same thing in France, same thing in other countries of the world. Black people looked at as secondary class human beings. And the people discriminate against them. We as Muslims have been told that there is no difference between a black person and a white person. The only difference between them is taqwa, piety. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he exercised that to the best. He put that into practice. When he dealt with his black companions, he treated them the same way he would treat his own son or his own brothers. Absolutely no difference between them. When he looked at different races, for example, as we said, he did not say, well, okay, he's an American and this guy is Russian or this guy is Turks or this guy, I don't know, from Europe, therefore I'm going to give them different treatment. He never done that. While today we see people discriminate against people based on the color of the hair and the color of the skin and their eyes, as you guys heard the Ukrainian president when he said, well, these are not Middle Eastern people, they are blondes. And many people said the same statement. So because they're blondes, they have blue eyes and green eyes, they have better chances or they should be treated differently than me who has a brown face and brown skin and have dark hair and dark eyes. See the discrimination here? Even based on the color of our eyes and the color of our skin, we can discriminate against one another. To Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, there's no difference between me and you. The only difference is how much I am submitting to Allah and how much you are submitting to Allah. Beside that, nothing else is different. And what is a better way to learn this through the school of Karbala, the University of Karbala, when you look at Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and you look at how he dealt with everyone exactly the same, without discrimination, without racism, without any prejudice, without him saying, well, I am the grandson of the Prophet and everyone is below me. Never did he do that. So we need to go back to Karbala and learn the basics of human rights. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.